All right, well, then we go for the last issue of today, which is all the stuff that has not been covered yet. we'll give you half an hour, Millie and Sue.
So we're gonna have some staff join us here.
Okay.
Get teed up really quickly, and then we can just go back and forth. Are your staff?
They should be. That's okay. You can start.
So for the final session, we have agenda paper 15, which, as Hans mentioned, lays out sort of all the other projects that the boards are working on that we haven't otherwise covered today. And the big takeaway, I think, is you look through Appendix A on the IASB projects and Appendix B on the FASB projects, is that there are, in fact, a number of additional projects where the topics are related, even though perhaps the scope or the timing of those projects might differ. So what we thought we would do today is cover three areas in particular, and if there are other things that you'd like to cover, we can certainly do that as well. But we'd start with the conceptual framework, if that works for you. I guess Peter will cover that, and then Rachel, if you want to come up here, and we'll cover that on the ISB side. We'll pause for any discussion or questions, and then we'll cover liabilities and equity and FICE on the ISB side. And then we'll cover asset acquisitions on the FASB side, which has some relationship to our research pipeline project on variable and contingent considerations for asset acquisitions. So I guess we'll go ahead and start with conceptual framework.
Okay, thank you. So the FASB's conceptual framework project was reactivated in 2014. And this was after it was ranked as a high priority in a survey of some key advisors for the board to work on. I would describe what we're trying to achieve as to improve and complete the framework. And if you complete it, then that's also an improvement. I don't want to get too semantical here. Anything we do in the framework is obviously to support the board's deliberations and frame a discussion as part of standard setting. The FASB framework is not authoritative in any way. So we talked earlier today about the disclosure part of the framework. So we added a new chapter that was that disclosure framework, and we talked about that. We also, in August of 2016, proposed a chapter on presentation. The idea there was that if information could be conveyed where you're combining homogeneous things and not combining things that are heterogeneous, it would be a better way to facilitate an analyst looking at data and forecasting future earnings and future cash flows. So what we proposed was seven factors that the board would consider. And so those included looking to what is causing the change, what the activity is that is the underlying to the gain or the loss, the income or expense. The frequency of the item, time until realization, the form of settlement, and changes in market factors and measurement methods. Now, like I said, these are to frame a discussion. If you take any particular sort of a transaction or event, it might meet more than one of these characteristics, but it's a way to just sort of provide some discipline around how we talk about it. We had fairly positive comments on that proposal. In some cases, our stakeholders wanted us to do more. For example, while we were mostly focused on the performance statement, they still had the idea of sort of relating all the statements to each other. And it comes up in a couple places, but we also have sort of acknowledged that we see no conceptual basis for other comprehensive income. And some stakeholders would prefer that we develop a conceptual merit to other comprehensive income. Another area relates to the elements definitions of assets, liabilities, revenues, expenses, etc. Part of this is really tightening up some of the language. So if you think about our current definition of an asset, it includes words like probable. It includes words like future economic benefit, controlled by a particular entity, a result of past transactions. And sometimes that can be confusing. the notion of probable, it's not really a threshold issue. You either have an asset or you don't have an asset. So we think the word probable is unnecessary and really just confuses the matter. The future economic benefit sometimes can put the attention on the future flow rather than the current right that exists at the balance sheet date. Whether controlled is necessary or redundant is sort of an open question. It's not a significant matter either way. And past transaction or events, you know, we spend some time trying to find that past transaction to prove there's an asset. Again, maybe it's easier just to say, do I have a present right or don't I? So some of that is to clean up, tidy up, tighten the language around the definition. If you look at the definition of liability, it uses similar terms, and so we would make complementary changes to that. Now, decisions have not been made. We've met with board members. We have their views that are tentative, but those are the issues we're talking about. We also, in our elements, talk about the idea of a constructive obligation. As far as constructive, all we're trying to do there is to describe that sometimes you can create a liability beyond the legal or contractual obligation. It can be from your actions and therefore the expectations that you've established with consequences if you don't follow through, if you will. We don't think there's a whole lot we can do better than that, but we will also look to make some clarifying improvements to the language there. In terms of stand-ready obligations, we talk about stand-ready obligations a lot. And at the staff level, we think we probably should try to stop using that term. Their obligations, their liability is no different than any other. The characteristic that makes them unique is the uncertainty of the outcome. And so we would probably advise the board to say, let's not create a class of citizen, a different class of citizen. They're all liabilities. The other aspect of elements that is we think is problematic in standard setting relates to where we draw the line between liabilities and equity. And under today's definition, a liability is a transfer of an asset. But we have standards that don't necessarily follow that strict application. So we're trying to figure out where that line is. And the line could be that liabilities are when you expect to transfer an asset to settle it, or you're transferring something that might be an equity security but doesn't have all the risks and rewards of an equity security, a sort of broader view of what a liability is. There's another view that says, well, it's rare that a transfer of an equity security has all the characteristics of ownership, and so even if you're transferring a security, an equity-type security, more likely than not, it's a liability. Those are the areas we're looking at in terms of elements. And the final area is measurement, and it's and you can argue, do we have a measurement chapter? We do. We currently have a measurement chapter in our conceptual framework, but it basically describes different measurement methods. It does not attempt to provide things to consider, factors that would drive you to one particular measurement or another. So in this part of the project, we've identified measurements like entry price, exit price, expected future cash flows, and we also acknowledge that in some cases it's just a calculation of a runoff, an amortization or accruals or something like that. We started looking at assets, and we believe that both entry price and exit price can be relevant and decision useful for assets. We looked at ways to try to draw that line. We thought of, you know, operating versus non-operating, financial, non-financial, in use, in exchange. And where we think we are at the moment is that if you have assets that are used in combination to generate cash flows, that we think entry price has some merit and relevance. It maintains those historical relationships that a user would use to do forecasting. And then for exit, while it's not entirely focused on financial assets, for the most part, financial assets we think have independent value. Buy-sell decisions are based on individual securities. They're not used in combination. So we think in those cases, exit value is relevant or more relevant, if I dare to say that. We haven't progressed very far on our thoughts on measurement, and what we're trying to do is to work closely with board members so that we can take our staff ideas, build upon them, and come up with something that's going to be helpful to the board as they move forward. Those are really the only comments I wanted to make on framework.
Many of these issues sound very familiar. Mm-hmm. So I would really encourage you to steal as much as possible and do better where you can.
And the balance we try to find is not to come up with something that's so prescriptive, but allows room to consider facts and circumstances with any standards level decisions.
Would it be useful for me to highlight where we've got to with?
Yeah, I think ever since this issued, we could probably just do a quick highlight.
As Hans said, a lot of the issues that you're grappling with there, I think, are very familiar to us from our conceptual framework project. We issued our revised conceptual framework back in March. It's going to be effective immediately for the board. Unlike you, we do have some preparers who are required to use the conceptual framework when developing accounting policies, although it's quite a limited population that you're looking at there. For them, they would be required to look at it from the 1st of January 2020. Like you, we're looking to improve, filling gaps and update where necessary rather than sort of fundamentally reconsidering everything to do with the conceptual framework. But we have made some significant changes. We do have a whole chapter on presentation and disclosure, which sets out very high-level concepts, which we're very much building on as part of the work that we're doing in the Primary Financial Statements Project and the Disclosure Initiative Project. We did grapple with OCI, and we do have some very high-level guidance on OCI, saying that we would generally have a default position of putting income and expenses into the statement of profit or loss. We would only use OCI if we could argue that that would provide more useful information to users than putting it into profit or loss. There's also an assumption there that you would recycle, again, unless there wasn't a reasonable basis for recycling that provided useful information to users in the period in which you did the recycling. In terms of definitions, as we said, I think we grapple with very similar issues. We've taken probable out of our definition of assets and liabilities, and we've put the reference to the flows associated with assets and liabilities into a separate definition of economic resource rather than within the actual definition of the assets and liabilities itself, to get away from the focus on the flows rather than on the assets. We did discuss control, and there were some suggestions that perhaps control might be redundant in the definition of assets and liabilities, but we decided to keep it along with the idea that you have a present right or a present obligation, because we thought taking it out would be more likely to confuse, and we didn't see any harm with keeping it in there. Interestingly, on the definition of a liability, you talked about the focus on past transactions and the fact that it could result in entities spending a long time trying to identify past transactions. We thought that was probably the case for assets, but when we came to look at liabilities, we actually found the reference to past transactions quite useful in terms of our liability definition, and in particular in situations where we were looking to move away from a strictly unconditional definition of a liability, and we found a reference to past transactions there was actually quite useful. We also don't refer to stand ready obligations in the revised conceptual framework. We tried to get away from the term because, as you say, it is all just about the uncertainty of outcomes. We decided to duck any questions about the definitions of liability and equity and the distinction between the two, and pass that all over to our vice project for them to deal with it. We thought we had enough of that thing, so. Measurement, I think this was the chapter that probably was the most difficult for us to actually develop, because our existing conceptual framework had very little on measurement, as are similar to yours, I think. We just simply described a few measurement bases that an entity could think about. What we've done in with the measurement chapter now is that we have expanded it significantly to describe the different measurement bases and describe the sorts of information that they provide, and then gone on to talk about the factors that an entity might need to consider in deciding or the board to consider in deciding which measurement approach would provide the most useful information to users. And we've tied it back very much to the fundamental characteristics of useful financial information. So you're looking at things that will provide relevant information and faithfully represent the transactions or events that you're looking to represent. We have some similar ideas to what you're talking about in terms of when you might want to think about assets used in combination, where we say that sometimes a historical cost approach might provide useful information about assets used in combination. And we say that if you're looking to sell assets, then it may be that some sort of fair value approach might provide useful information. So overall, I think, as Hans said, we have covered quite a lot of the sort of issues that you're looking at there, and please do steal from us.
I mean, that'd be something if we end up converged.
Well, great. Should we move on to liabilities and equity and finance?
Does anybody have any questions for them? Is my team there?
That's right.
We're all here for the next topic.
Oh, okay.
Then I have Jennifer, Alicia, and Adriana.
I'll just say on the definition of a liability, I'm glad you sort of retain the idea of a past transaction. Whenever we've talked about these issues, and whether it's in World Standard Setters or our FRIC conference, I feel like we end up spending the majority of our time trying to identify the obligating event. To get rid of the words past transactions sort of belies the analysis that we're all trying to do. Whenever we are struggling in a particular fact pattern, we're always trying to say, well, which event happened that obligated us to do this? And so I thought the words helped.
All right.
You want to do FICE first or do you want to do ours first?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Mary, you want to give us a brief update?
Sure. So in September of 2017, the FASB added a project to its agenda on distinguishing liabilities from equity. And the objective of our project is to improve the understandability and reduce the complexity of the guidance while not reducing information to financial statement users. So we're really looking at improving the guidance within the current construct of the liabilities and equities guidance we have today, and we're looking at three main areas. We're looking at convertible instruments. So there we've got a number of different models depending on the exact features. So can we reduce the number of models, indexation and settlement in the context of the derivatives scope exception, so trying to make it a little easier to identify if an instrument or feature is indexed to an entity's own stock and how the impact of cash or share settlement impacts that classification. So last month, the board began initial deliberations on the project, and they gave us direction on convertible instruments and the indexation components. We're going to come back to the settlement piece later this year. But for convertible instruments, the board directed the staff to focus on a model where you've got the host instrument, so the debt or the preferred stock, is a single unit of account along with the conversion feature, so no longer bifurcating those conversion features unless they meet the definition of a derivative. So we're not going to touch the derivative accounting, but for everything else, can we have it be a single unit of account? And for that single unit of account, we'd follow a model similar to traditional convertible debt, which is, in our accounting construct today, that's accounted as a single debt instrument under amortized cost. So we're currently starting research on that based on the board direction, and then along with that, measurement and recognition guidance, we're also looking at, can we make improvements to the related EPS and disclosures. For the indexation leg of the project, the board directed us to do further research on two different paths on indexation. Those paths are referred to as monetary value and anti-dilution. So the monetary value path is, under that path, an instrument or feature wouldn't be indexed to an entity's own stock if the monetary value of the obligation is based solely or predominantly on a fixed monetary value or on variation in something other than the fair value of the entity shares. And then the other approach we're looking at is the anti-dilution approach. So under that approach, an instrument or embedded feature would be considered indexed to an entity's own stock if its settlement amount is equal to the difference between the fair value of a fixed number of the entity shares and a fixed monetary amount of a debt instrument issued by the entity. And then if the settlement aspect of it is variable, the only type of variation you could have that wouldn't preclude equity classification is if that settlement amount is impacted by a standard anti-dilution provision. So that's a term we have defined in GAAP. So think of just some standard anti-dilution like mergers, stock splits, things like that. So, you know, as I mentioned, we just got that direction last month, so the staff is undergoing research on those, and we'll come back to the board for decision.
Any questions for Mary on that approach?
I just wondered whether you've explored your work on the conceptual framework and the links between what you've been doing with conceptual framework and this project.
So we're monitoring what's happening with the conceptual framework project as we develop this, but I think the current project we have is to focus on, in the current construct that we have, how we can make improvements. And interestingly, I think Peter might have touched on this a little bit, you know, that the current conceptual framework is inconsistent with the current standards level guidance, so we already have an inconsistency there. And because of the timing and you know, want the desire to make improvements to this area in the near term, you know, we're moving ahead with this, but kind of monitoring what's going on with conceptual framework. We're not necessarily dependent on that direction, but we're kind of monitoring each other's work to inform where we're headed.
Sue?
So can I just confirm, so under our literature, we bifurcate convertible bonds into debt and equity instruments. You're not looking at that. You're staying with a single unitary measure. Did I understand correctly?
That's right. So we've done some research with financial statement users, and what we found is the bifurcation is very confusing in terms of they're trying to put all the pieces back together. So from the usefulness of the information, we're looking at putting it as a single instrument and then trying to give them that additional information through disclosures and EPS. So they'll still have everything that they need, but it won't be bifurcated with different pieces across the balance sheet and then taking away some of the P&L volatility.
But, so today we have four bifurcation models and one non-separation model. So I get why they're confused about the four, but the research the team did said they don't really like any bifurcation model.
But to be clear, right, we're still the scope of this, Sue, and help me if I'm wrong on this, Mary, but the scope is for those instruments where there isn't an embedded derivative under the literature already. If there's something we're not touching the definition of a derivative. If there's an embedded derivative as defined in topic 815, you got to pull it out and you got to bifurcate it. It's in those situations where you don't meet the definition of a derivative that we're talking about not bifurcating. So it might not be as massive a change as or divergence as it might initially appear.
But I think we're already quite different, I think it's just
Mary.
Well, it's just it's an observation because on its face, Mary, when you describe, you know, the three areas of focus, and it sounded like quite different approaches from what we're doing in our FICE project. But when I think about some of the things you said about how you're approaching it, I can map them very much to some of the issues we're considering. So it may just be helpful for us to think as two boards about just doing not an exhaustive mapping process, but just here's how this relates to what the other board is considering here, and it's for your selected topics that maybe just making, you know, we can point to which is the piece of the 100 and however many pages of the FICE DP paper that's about to drop, because I think some of what you're saying about indexation and settlement, if it's based solely or predominantly on monetary value or something other than owned shares might actually link. It's a different expression of some of the things we were thinking about in terms of is there an amount that's independent of the entity's available economic resources.
Personally, I'd caution because I think our starting positions are just
true
fundamentally different.
I'm not saying this should be viewed as a convergence opportunity, but I think it may end up sounding more different than it is because some of what I think you're thinking about, I can relate to some of the things we've been discussing. Okay. Sue and I are in raging disagreement here.
All right.
Any other questions? So I can just, I think you've got a little bit of a flavor for FICE from the conversation, but just to round out that discussion a little bit, as Mary mentioned, the DP will be coming out later this month. We'll have a six-month comment period. And at a very high level, what the board is seeking to do is improve the information that's provided to investors, but not a massive overhaul of IAS 32, which is the literature on presentation of financial instruments. And part of the reason for that is that we found that IAS 32 did provide a robust model throughout the financial crisis. And so really it's more that as time has progressed, there's been innovation and there's been instruments that have been developed around the margins that has led to some diversity in practice due to complex features that smell a little bit like liability, smell a little bit like equity. And so there's really a focus on three areas with respect to this project. The first is articulating a principle that'll provide a clear rationale for whether a financial instrument is presented as a liability or equity. And that principle, it sort of boils down to two key features, the first being a timing feature, which would involve whether the investor or the issuer, can be required to pay cash or hand over another asset before liquidation. And then the other feature is an amount feature, which involves whether the issuer has promised a particular return to the holder, regardless of its own performance and share price. So if you meet one or both of those features, then you would be a liability. The second piece that the project is seeking to address is just improve consistency and completeness and clarity of the classification requirements. And then the third piece, which I think is particularly important, is improving the disclosures around the features of these financial liabilities and equities, to making sure that there's the sufficient information and improve the information that's being provided to investors. So stay tuned. We'll have that issued in a couple weeks. So any questions on FICE, or we can move on in our last few minutes to asset acquisitions?
Okay.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. So the project on improvements.
You want to introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. I'm glad you can see me, because I'm not really sure about that either. But my name is Adriana Yepes, and I'm the project manager on improving the accounting for asset acquisitions and business combinations. And this is Alicia Pasta. So this project was added to the agenda in 2013 as part of the larger definition of a business project. And the main objective of the project was to attempt to align some of the differences between the accounting and asset acquisition in a business combination.
16.
In 2017, the board decided that the scope of the project would really focus in on three main issues: accounting for contingent consideration, IPR&D, and transaction costs. So because the objective is really to align what one would think is what the accounting is under two current models, then the alternatives that we're considering already exist. However, one of the challenges in phase three is that in the asset acquisitions model, it's not really a single developed model, and therefore some of the items that we're proposing are actually going to be new to both models. Another challenge is really the scope of the project. So ultimately, asset acquisition model will still be a cost accumulation model, and the BizCom model will, for the most part, still be a fair value model that will still continue to exist after this project. So now I'm going to walk through the current accounting requirements and some of the alternatives that we've discussed with the board, most recently at a non-decision-making meeting in May. So for contingent consideration in a business combination, contingent consideration, and we're strictly talking about that is classified as a liability, it's recognized at fair value at the acquisition date, and changes in fair value are then marked through the P&L. And in asset acquisition in GAAP, there's diversity in practice. Some folks recognize contingent consideration if they think it's probable and reasonably estimable, and others recognize the liability once the contingency is resolved. So at the May 9th meeting, the staff presented alternatives that were in line with current GAAP. One alternative was initial measurement on day one at fair value. The other alternative was recognition once the contingency was resolved. The staff also discussed a middle ground alternative where initial recognition would really be based on a threshold. And the thresholds that we talked about was a threshold that would be more likely than not or a probable threshold to only recognize it in those circumstances. However, those alternatives presented a number of subsequent measurement issues, so there wasn't a lot of interest in those alternatives. For the alternative with day one recognition, there was discussion on two subsequent measurement issues, and that's the when and where. When do you recognize the changes, and where would you recognize them? So the staff is proposing four alternatives for when to recognize. The first alternative is going to be consistent with 805, which is recognized on an ongoing basis. The second alternative is to remeasure it on an annual basis. The third alternative is to remeasure if a significant event occurs. And the fourth alternative is to adjust it really once the contingency is resolved. So at the last meeting, what the board members seemed most interested in alternative two and three, which was either annual remeasurement or remeasurement upon a significant event. In terms of the question of where do we measure the obligation, the staff presented three options. One is in line with 805, which is remeasurement through earnings. The second option is through OCI, and the third option is to make the changes through the assets acquired, which is in line with the asset acquisition model. And at that last board meeting, it seemed like most board members were interested in the third option. At that meeting, the staff also noted that some estimates of the fair value contingent consideration are really too uncertain and therefore may not faithfully depict the obligation of the acquirer. The board supported the staff's suggestion that further research should be performed on a recognition constraint, and the focus is specifically going to be on royalty payments or payments that are in store. For IPR and D, the alternatives under consideration are really based on the two current models. Alternative A is to capitalize IPR and D and hold it as an indefinite-lived intangible asset tested for impairment until the project is complete. Any costs related to that project are currently expensed. The other option is to expense IPR&D upon acquisition and consistent with Topic 730. And for transaction costs, we're really looking really at two options. One is to capitalize transaction costs consistent with asset acquisitions or to expense them consistent with BizCom accounting. And with that, in terms of next steps, we're really trying to do some outreach to better understand what the effects of constraining contingent consideration would be. Also, we're working on really defining contingent consideration in an asset acquisition because there is the potential to scope in more things than perhaps we've thought about.
Any questions?
Mary?
Yeah, just a quick one. So you identified three aspects, the contingent consideration, IPR&D, and transaction costs. Is that because you think these are the three biggest sources of differences in accounting between asset acquisitions and BizCom, or because they're kind of exempt, you know, the best examples of three areas where there are differences? I mean, how much is this, your guess about the total of the population you have to address, or just the first kind of things in each area to knock off? How big is this problem about aligning asset and business?
Initially, we did an inventory of all of the differences. What we noted was most, whether it was preparers, auditors, most of them tended to focus in on these three particular areas as significant. In addition to that, as a result of phase one, where we narrowed the definition of a business, I think there's more real estate and pharma transactions falling in asset acquisitions, and these areas are probably important to them.
Great, thanks.
Any other questions? Peter, do you want to talk about our research pipeline project?
Yeah, so we've got a research pipeline project. So that's a research project that's not yet active, but we expect it to become active over the next few months, which will be looking at variable and contingent consideration. That comes really because the Interpretations Committee had several questions that came to it, probably about 2 or 3 years ago, I guess. But they were looking at particular fact patterns. They weren't really looking generally at contingent and variable consideration. Now, of course, we have got some aspects of that that have been picked up in standards. So, for example, both revenue recognition and leases
picked up also some relatively specific fact patterns. And, of course, business combination accounting also deals with contingent consideration in business combinations. So our first step will be to look at the landscape and see how wide this range of issues is and then figure out what the scope is for the next stage. If I could mention the other things that were sort of on your shopping list. First of all, on definition of a business, by the way, we're in the final stages of drafting our amendments to the definition of a business, which is sort of catching up with where you were when you issued your amendments. In process R&D, I don't think we're doing anything that's relevant to that. And we don't have any project that's looking at transaction costs. I will just mention that our new, shiny new measurement chapter in the conceptual framework does talk about transaction costs in a historical cost-based measurement. So I think we might get some inspiration from that. I hope we will anyway. And I will also mention that another area that people mention to us as a difference between business combination accounting and asset acquisitions is deferred tax. In IFRS, we have an exemption on day one if you acquire individual assets and if there's a temporary difference on day one. We don't have that exemption for a business combination, so that creates some tensions. One other thing I'll say on the contingency, I've heard quite a lot about that, and I think pharma seems to be one of the test cases for that. If you acquire some early stage drug with some contingent consideration that's contingent on whether you get to the next stage of approval, when you pass the next stage of approval, the contingent payment's triggered, but obviously your asset becomes a lot more valuable at that stage. And I think the existing accounting under our business combination standard is that you've got the liability on and being remeasured, but the asset not, by and large, not being remeasured, and obviously that's not making people particularly happy.
Any questions or observations?
All we have. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That brings us to the end of a fruitful day, full of very good discussions. I would like to thank both staffs, especially Nili and Sue, for preparing this and filling the day with good topics to discuss. Very well done. And I would like to thank again the FESB members and staff for taking the time to come here and join us for a good day of discussions. We'll celebrate that in a proper fashion tonight. Okay. Thank you very much.